here with Lori McCandish King, not Lori King, the Lori McCandish King. How are you?
Great to see you, Tom. I'm fine. How are you today?
Yeah. Just so people know, there is a difference.
There's a big difference. These are travel books we're talking about here, travel stories.
And speaking of that, that's why I want to talk with you. You have a new book coming out called Your Crocodile Has Arrived.
I do. I'm so excited that it's out now. The big launch party is going to be in August, but it's available now online and at bookstores. And it's 21 true travel stories, incidents that happened all around the world. And it's called Your Crocodile Has Arrived because one of the stories is about when I was in Australia at a restaurant eating crocodile, and the server came up and said, Your crocodile has arrived, and it turned out to be a nice title for the story.
And nobody was scared.
No, it was quite dead. And quite chewy, as a matter of fact. It was very dead.
Well, let's back up for a moment, because this is your second book in a series of Lori McCandish King's stories from the edge of the world. Tell us about book one for a moment.
The first book is called Lost, Kidnapped, Eaten Alive, and that's because it included stories about my being lost in a city of 3 million, kidnapped in Tunisia, where I feared for my life, and appropriately so, and eaten alive by leeches. That was also in Australia, and that was creepy.
So this is a series of like-kind stories from all around the world.
All around the world. I was in Scotland, Trinidad, Australia, Sri Lanka, Taiwan, Alaska, all over the place. And in each of those places, this one has a kind of a theme. I saw a lot of loss. I saw habitat loss and extinction. I saw loss of ways of living. And those things really touched me. I also, though, saw stories of people who were trying to help. For example, I saw leatherback turtles that are battling extinction in Trinidad. They're incredible creatures. Only 1 in 1,000 lives.
To begin with.
To begin with. And there are people in Trinidad who are spending their lives trying to help these creatures, trying to keep the beaches clear for them, trying to help them make it, little baby ones back to sea so they can live. There are people who are just dedicating their lives to helping this species survive. And that was such a wonderful story. I really wanted to get that kind of story out there. There's so many inspiring things in the world, and I just happened to see a bunch of them, and the stories really moved me, and I wanted to get them out there.
It's reaffirming when you bump into people who care around the world.
Yeah. There was another incident. I was in Sri Lanka, and there was an elephant that had been, you know, they had a civil war that lasted for 30 years in Sri Lanka, and it's been over for 5 or 6 years, I think. But during the course of that, there were a lot of landmines, and there's an elephant in Sri Lanka, probably many, but one that got its leg blown off, an accident with a landmine. And so it's now in an elephant orphanage that was established to help elephants that weren't making it for one reason or another. There were baby elephants who would be orphaned. There were some that would fall into water tanks and not be able to get out. So again, there are people who are dedicating their lives to helping these creatures have a normal rest, as normal as possible, rest of their life.
You spent time with the elephants up close and personal.
Oh my gosh, it was amazing. These creatures, I've always heard how amazing elephants are, but I guess you don't really get it until you're right there with them. The thing that was so memorable about this particular three-legged elephant is that it's been like that, had only three legs for, I don't know, maybe a decade, and it can't really walk very well. It can't support itself. It spends most of its time just leaning against a fence. And looking that elephant in the eye, you'd see so much emotion in that elephant. I never knew that before. I never knew that you could see that emotion in an elephant's eye. It was just unforgettable. That's why I wrote that story, because it moved me so much. I will never forget seeing that elephant.
There's a woman in San Diego I need to introduce you to. She got so into whales, she went down to Dominican Republic and was diving with the whales, and she was 4 feet from a mother whale, and it looked her in the eye.
Oh my gosh.
And it changed her life. She said she now wakes up every morning with a big smile because of whales.
That's beautiful. That is really beautiful.
But that's that same thing. There is that spirit and that soul that comes through the eye of the animal. That's profoundly powerful.
It is.
You were there.
There are some other stories, though, that are not quite so profound, but they're amazing nevertheless. For example, in Gippsland, Australia, I was able to see one of the longest earthworms in the world. And this little tiny area in Australia, it's only 100 and some square miles, they have what's called the giant Gippsland earthworm. That thing grows to be 20 feet long. An earthworm that long, and it only lives in that one specific area, and they're dying out. They're becoming extinct for a number of reasons, pesticides, and the land is being used for farming, and who knows what else. But
you saw them cruising along?
Well, I actually saw them in a worm zoo, in a worm museum it was, a worm museum. And the building was shaped like a worm. It was the coolest thing.
That's funny. Well, I just went to the Salt and Pepper Shaker Museum.
Oh, my gosh, where's that?
Tennessee.
Yeah? Cool.
Gatlinburg.
I'll have to listen to your podcast about that. That sounds good.
Yeah, well, the Worm Museum wins.
The Worm Museum totally wins. It's incredible. There was a photograph in there from, I think it was probably the 1960s or so, of three farmers out in a field holding one worm, and they're standing at arm's length from each other, and this was one of the 20-foot ones, and it just, they're, each one is sort of struggling to hold up this delicate, long, stringy thing. It's amazing.
So they put that on their roadside coming into town?
Yeah. Giant Worm Museum.
Let's move on to another most memorable moment from your book.
You know, in Sri Lanka, I heard when I went there that there is an amazing place where it's called the Temple of the Tooth. And there is a tooth that supposedly belonged to the Buddha. So it's a 2,500-year-old tooth. It was supposedly rescued by his followers after he was cremated. They went into the ashes and got this tooth.
Is it a molar or...
I figured it should be a wisdom tooth, you know?
Yeah. Naturally.
Of course. But you don't actually get to see the tooth. The tooth is inside, they call it a casket, a reliquary, and that's inside another one, and that's inside another one. So there are seven of these things. And they're inside a huge temple. And every day, three times a day, thousands of people come and stand in line. And they're Buddhists, so they're so polite and so sweet and so gentle. It's not like standing in line in America for something. I mean, it's just these lovely, lovely people standing in line for an opportunity to walk past the outermost casket that holds this tooth. It looks like a Pope's hat. It's kind of conical shaped, and it's, I don't know, maybe 4 feet tall, and it's all gold. Bright, shiny, has lights on it, and it's just dripping with gold and pearls. It's just amazing. We got to file past it one at a time very quickly and get a very quick look at it. And what amazed me was it was breathtaking to see that. It was just breathtaking.
You know, you had to imagine what the tooth looked like.
Yeah, you didn't even have to think about the tooth. And being there with these people who have stood in line literally for hours, and they're all sweet-tempered, and they don't mind if you push in front of them. I tried to be as polite as I could, but I also wanted to see it. That was perhaps the most... Well, no, there are a couple more really memorable experiences, too. All right, I got a couple more. One of them was in St. Petersburg. There's a museum there, it's an ethnographic museum, and part of the museum is stocked with medical specimens that Peter the Great collected back in the 1700s.
Human or animal?
Both human and animal. Most of the ones that I saw were human. And what Peter the Great was trying to do was bring Russia out of the superstitious era, and he had traveled in Europe and was very impressed with what the Europeans were doing, and he was trying to make Russians more European. That was one of his things. And one of the things that concerned him about superstition was that people in Russia believed that if a person had a child with a deformity, that the mother had obviously consorted with the devil. So the whole family then was shunned, and the child was shunned. And Peter the Great wanted his people to see that in the natural world, there are these things like deformities, but it comes from God. Everything comes from God. That was his perspective. So he wanted people to see that it's normal and natural to have unnatural births. It's an odd perspective. But so he had collected all these things, and there are hundreds of glass jars with specimens in them, and many of them are of sort of deformities. And it just was, it was fascinating to look at, and it was fascinating to look at now from the perspective that we have now, where we're doing so much genetic engineering, and we have chimeras that are part animal and or part one animal and part another, but that genetically are from two different species. We have this brave new world that we're coming into now, and to just see what it was like back in the 1700s for someone to be thinking about those things and then compare that to what it's like now, that was an amazing experience too. It was unforgettable to see that.
That's so cool.
Okay, one more.
Okay, one more. I went to a UFO convention. This was in Denver a few years ago, and I thought that the people there would be kind of wackos. What, you know, what do you think of when you think of people who are into UFOs?
Tinfoil hats.
Tinfoil hats. Most of the people there were retired U.S. military personnel, retired men who then had gone on to work after they were in the military for Westinghouse and GE and some of the big, prestigious, impressive companies. And, you know, these are not wacko homeless veterans who have PTSD and are having trouble figuring out what's what or making it in the world. These were successful business people, and they had all had experiences that made them believe in UFOs. So here I was, not a believer, in the midst of very respectable seeming people who were believers, and I was really the odd person out here.
I love that, turning the tables. Yeah. It's a weirdo.
Yes. What's wrong with her? She doesn't get it. The experience that I really remember from that was listening to one particular scholar who asked me not to use his name outside the convention. But he said, just refer to me as an Ivy League trained astrophysicist, which he was, who is affiliated with SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. So he said, that will keep me anonymous enough because there are a lot of people who fit that description. I'm only one of many people who are like that who believe in UFOs. And he explained his theory about how UFOs are powered. You know, they don't use any kind of engines that we're familiar with. So his lecture was about how the things are powered. And I'm not going to give it away, partly because it's too complicated for me. I could barely understand it when he said it. Fortunately, I recorded him. I took some really good notes. So I do have some of the details in the story, but I wouldn't try to attempt to explain it now. But just fascinating to hear people who are very well educated and have very different opinions from my own.
Give me a little bit more in the breath, because I know there's some chapters waiting to be read by me anyway.
Okay, well, another one that was really fun was when I was in Taipei, and I had heard that they have these fabulous soup dumplings in Taipei. They're Chinese, but they're all over China, but I happen to be in Taiwan. So I tracked down the soup dumpling men. I wanted to find out, these soup dumplings, they're not dumplings that are floating in soup. They're dumplings that have soup inside the dumpling. I wanted to find out, how do they get the soup inside the dumpling? You know, you think about it. Do they make a dumpling around the soup? No. Do they inject the soup into a dumpling that's already made? No, that doesn't really work either. So the secret to the soup dumplings is also in the book.
So you have to buy the book to find out.
You have to buy the book to find that out.
I love it. Got to keep us on the edge.
Okay, one more. I was in Seville in Spain for Holy Week. And Seville is in Andalusia, the part of Spain that has a lot of Moorish influence has had over history, and they had a hammam, an ancient bath there, and I thought, well, this will be a great place to try a hammam and go into the spa and have their treatment and see what it's like. And they had something called chocotherapy. Well, I had never heard of chocotherapy, but it sounded pretty terrific. You know, how bad can it be? So what it turned out to be was an experience in which you soak in these beautiful hot waters in a gorgeous ancient building with flickering candlelight and fabulous music, soft lights, soft music. It was wonderful. And then you have a massage with chocolate sauce. So I got my whole body chocolate massaged in Spain, and I wrote about that too. That was really fun.
That's way cool.
There's another story that really moved me. And that's an experience that I had on Angel Island, which is in San Francisco Bay. And there's an old immigration station on Angel Island, and they've made a museum there. I didn't know much about the history of it, but a lot of Chinese people came into America through the Angel Island immigration station. It was called the Ellis Island of the West. And Ellis Island proper, it took about 3.5 hours on average to get through as an immigrant. And on the Angel Island immigration station, it took about 3.5 weeks on average. And for some people, it took close to 2 years to get through, because there was a huge amount of prejudice against Chinese people. And in fact, we had the Chinese Exclusion Act happening back then. That was the first law in America that was specifically made to keep a particular nationality out of America, because Americans were worried that Chinese people would take their jobs. So we had this immigration station that was basically set up to regulate the flow of Chinese people coming into America. And of course, they did come in and they did take jobs. They built our railroads. They did all that horrible mining work that was backbreaking and life-threatening. They were huge contributors to the development of the West Coast. Yes, they did work here.
Pretty much all the jobs that nobody else wanted to do to begin with.
Yeah. Sound familiar, huh? Yeah. I mean, you really see this story about immigration through history, and it gave me a really broader perspective looking at the whole immigration situation that we have now, and also looking at the conditions that people lived in there. One of the things that struck me most was that there was this belief that Chinese men didn't use mattresses at home in China, bed mattresses. So therefore, when they came through the immigration station, no mattresses for you. The women apparently got them. I don't know how they thought that the women had mattresses at home and men didn't. I don't know what. But in the immigration station, they separated families. They separated men from women and treated them pretty badly. It was really interesting to look at what went on then. And what I heard is that they're building another museum now on Angel Island that will have to do with immigration on the whole West Coast, not just with that particular immigration station. So it'll be interesting to see what happens there in the future and keep an eye on what's going on with that museum.
I think one of the fascinating things is some of the original structures are there.
Yeah.
With actually some of their writings on the wall.
Well, in fact, that's why there's a museum there, because some of the people who were there wrote poetry, carved poetry into the walls, and it got painted over and painted over and painted over, but because it had been carved and who knows, just something about the poetry, it endured, and somebody discovered poetry carved into the walls, and that's where the impetus came from to make a museum of some of these older buildings. And when we were there visiting one of the docents, who it turned out his parents had both come in through Angel Island Immigration Station, and so he learned a lot about what had happened and, of course, had heard stories growing up, and now he's a historian. And he read some of the poetry to us in Chinese and remarked about how beautiful the poetry was and how much attention to detail there was, how much knowledge about history there was, how classical the poetic form was. So these were not just regular people scrawling into the walls. This was real poetry, and it was beautiful. That's why we have a museum there now, because somebody discovered that poetry and got the grants to make a museum.
And it's operated by Department of the Interior. Who runs it? National Park Service?
It's the National Park Service, the Angel Island Immigration Station Foundation. Oh, here, I have a poem. I have two from there. Living on island away from home elicits 100 feelings. My chest is filled with a sadness I cannot bear to explain. Night and day, I sit passively and listlessly. Fortunately, I have a novel as my companion. So this agony and heartbreak and pathos, and then a heck of a sense of humor, too, on the end of it. Here's another one. Why should one complain if he is detained and imprisoned here? From ancient times, heroes were often the first ones to face adversity. What a great attitude. We all can learn so much from that. It's just inspiring.
I love it because it's a voice from the past talking to you.
Yeah.
Okay, to learn more, if somebody wanted to get your book fresh off the press, how would they do it?
Fresh off the press, it's available online at Amazon.com and at IndieBound if you want to shop at an independent bookstore. Bookstores can order it also. They may or may not have it in stock, but they can certainly order it. But it's called Your Crocodile Has Arrived.
By Laurie McCandish King.
Yeah, thanks, Tom. Great talking to you.
always you light up my life when you show up. I always call you the Lemur Queen. There's a reason why.
Oh, yeah, that was in the first book, Seeing Lemurs in Madagascar. That was a great story, too.
I'm Tom Wilmer, reporting from Morro Bay, where we've been visiting with Laurie McCandish King, author and world traveler.
You've been listening to the Lowell Thomas Award-winning travel show Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer, a featured podcast on NPR.org's podcast directory. Produced by California Central Coast NPR affiliate KCBX. You are invited to subscribe to Journeys of Discovery with Tom Wilmer on NPR.org, NPR One, iTunes, and more than 20 other podcast channels around the world. To learn more about Tom Wilmer's journeys around America and the world, log on to thomaswilmer.com.